This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 14th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 290. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, remember when Canada's BlackBerry ruled the smartphone world? Well, there's a movie about it now based on a book by two Canadian journalists. My guest is one of them. Jackie McNish, former senior correspondent with the Wall Street Journal and former senior writer with the Globe and Mail. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or are highway overpasses just too much trouble? How many more trucks are we going to let run into them? And the protesters that show up with banners and flags for their cause du jour? Solution: tear them all down. Highway overpasses are a nuisance. Nobody will ever run into one again, and protesters can go find somewhere else to oppose whatever they want to oppose. In a province where a dam is costing $16 billion and a subway project is killing small businesses, how did highway overpasses become the most controversial infrastructure in BC? Truckers are slamming into highway overpasses at an alarming rate, and they're costing taxpayers millions of dollars to fix. Meanwhile, the provincial government took action last week to stop folks from peacefully gathering to exercise freedom of speech. A May 11th court injunction to stop gays against groomers, anti-vaxxers, and people with those truck Fudo flags from protesting on the overpass at the Mountain Highway interchange in North Vancouver. Yes, I said truck Fudo. That's because this is a family podcast. The transportation minister, Rob Fleming, said that protesters distracted drivers. And now police have the power to arrest protesters, no matter how peaceful they are. So ironic, because BC NDP Premier David Eby became famous with the BC Civil Liberties Association. He fought the good fight so that Vancouverites could protest whenever and wherever against the 2010 Winter Olympics and their sponsors. His legal advisor is Craig Jones, who got arrested in 1997 outside his UBC dorm. His crime? Hanging small paper signs that said free speech and democracy on a fence at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. He wanted to get the attention of visiting dictators. The biggest voices to stop the protests in North Vancouver were culture warriors on the left. They conveniently forgot how protesters on a Kelowna overpass gathered peacefully in 2020 to oppose the Coastal GasLink pipeline. They also forgot the Defund the Police banner that was hung on the viaducts last fall in downtown Vancouver. Despite the charter guaranteeing free speech and peaceful assembly, this could be the beginning of the end for peaceful protests on high visibility, high traffic highway overpasses around BC. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
What do you call it?
It's called a BlackBerry.
Huh. Try typing with your thumbs.
BlackBerry. A fascinating Canadian business and tech story. How Canadian technology helped change the world of telecommunications. Directed by Canadian Matt Johnson. It's based on the book, Losing the Signal, The Untold Story Behind the Extraordinary Rise and Spectacular Fall of BlackBerry, by Jackie McNish and Sean Silkoff. It premiered in the Berlin Film Festival in February, but it opens this week in theaters across Canada.
Yeah, what can I do for you?
Okay, picture a cell phone and an email machine all in one thing. There is a free wireless internet signal all across North America, and nobody has figured out how to use it.
Joining us on the podcast is co-author Jackie McNish, formerly of the Wall Street Journal and Globe and Mail. I had the privilege of assisting Jackie as a stringer for the Wall Street Journal during coverage of the Meng Wanzhou extradition saga in Vancouver. And I want to welcome Jackie to the Breaker.News podcast from Toronto.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's great to talk to you and catch up. Now, Jackie, your 288-page book has been turned into a movie, a dramedy about the cell phone and email machine all in one, as they say in the trailer. There's actors portraying the minds of BlackBerry, Mike Lazaridis and Douglas Fregan, and the money, Jim Balsillie. When did you see the movie for the first time, and how did you react to seeing your work transformed for the silver screen and watch the story unfold in front of your eyes?
It was very exciting to be in Berlin. The Berlinale is one of the great film festivals of the world. And it was alongside major productions. So the cast and crew have been incredible to Sean and I. We sat with them and watched the movie, and I came away with two things. One is this is a cast that loved making this film. Glenn Howerton, all the characters, Jay Baruchel, were working together. You could just see the energy and the excitement that they really enjoyed making this film. So it was really interesting to see that. At first, I think I had two responses, and I had like two parts of my brain whirring in different directions. The audience loved the movie. There was lots of laughter, lots of excitement, really dramatic moments, and the pace and the musical score were incredible. Because Sean and I had worked for so long on getting the facts correct in a story that had been untold at that point, I had this sort of fact-check brain in my, I'm sitting there watching a film and going, oh, that's not right. That's not how it happened. But I came, and it was hard to adjust to that, to be honest, but I came to the understanding that you couldn't make a movie by copying what was in our book. You had to do something very different because it's a different medium. It's not fact-based. It's entertainment. It wants to draw out emotions. It wants to simplify stories so you get the sense of it. It could not bog itself down in the technology, all the different complex things that happened to the company. So I saw it again, the second time and then the third time. And by the third time, I really, really liked it. And there's some really, really great scenes that capture it that I think that they have done an extraordinary job, and they took a gamble because it's hard to take liberties with facts. And it works because you get the essence, the emotional essence, the emotional rise and fall, the costs, all the things that have happened to BlackBerry in a movie that's only an hour and 25 minutes.
What drew you to the story of BlackBerry? What led you to write the book? What made the people tick behind the scenes?
Well, my colleague Sean Silkoff was the technology reporter at the time at the Globe and Mail, and he had been doing a number of stories, and he was getting closer than most people to what was going on. And I was asked to step in and help him. And BlackBerry was very careful about its communications at that time. It was very difficult to speak to Mike Lazaridis, the founder, Jim Balsillie, one of the co-CEO with Mike. They didn't want to talk. It was very difficult to get any information or conversation from them. They were in the limelight fighting patent battles and dealing with a lot of challenges. And so the Globe said, figure out what's going on here. Why is this company that has been so successful slipping? What happened? So it was a long process, and in the process, we were able to produce some big features about moments when Mike Lazaridis stepped away and Jim Balsillie stepped away from the board of directors and ultimately the company. So we got a taste of it. And Howard Yoon, an agent in New York with a very good literary agency, phoned us up. He cold called us and said, how'd you guys like to write a book? We said some thought about it, and it didn't take long to say yes. And that led to two contracts, one with HarperCollins in Canada and the other with Flatiron Books in New York.
Now, BlackBerry made an impact in so many ways, tech, business, pop culture. President Barack Obama was using it. It became popular in China. In 2006, my editor gave me a BlackBerry to go to the Grey Cup in Winnipeg. And a BlackBerry that was top of the line at the time, had video. The video, based on today's standards, was rather rudimentary. But still, it was a small device that I could write all my stories there from the practices, from the game, from the dressing room, get video of the BC Lions hoisting the Grey Cup and send it back to Vancouver as soon as possible. But like so many things that come from Canada, it was underappreciated in many ways. Waterloo, Ontario became a major player along with Silicon Valley. What were the highest highs and the lowest lows of BlackBerry?
You know, I think that you've touched upon the high, because people of our generation remember when they got their first BlackBerry. It was like you had just become a member of this club, because I can remember in the mid-90s, I'd be interviewing, like, you know, the first BlackBerry came out in 1998, and it was a little rudimentary, but, you know, it worked. You got your emails, and it liberated you from your office, and you were constantly connected to the internet and to communications. And I remember I would be interviewing bankers, lawyers, CEOs, executives, and they could be looking under their desk at their BlackBerry, and it was revolutionary. IBM had failed to do it. Motorola failed to do it. Numerous companies had failed to figure out how they could get data messages across the networks at that time that were very primitive. And Mike Lazaridis's genius was being economical with how the data was transmitted. I don't know if you remember when you had your first BlackBerry, you got to, from, subject line, and a couple of lines. And at the bottom of a couple of lines, you got more. When you clicked more, the research in motion network that BlackBerry operated would send another little packet of data, and then you would keep clicking more, so it didn't overload the system. And that revolutionized communications. We no longer had to be at an office. If you were a salesperson, you didn't have to phone in all the time. On cell phones at the time were the size of a shoebox. You didn't have to carry a 15-pound laptop with you. You had this thing in your pocket, and you were constantly connected. And that was the beginning of the revolution. And the high came very quickly, because the first BlackBerry came out in about 1998. And they did something very smart. And this was under Jim Balsillie's direction. He oversaw the sales crew. And he said, go out there and make a lot of noise so that everyone who's looking at you saying, who's that idiot? I want to be that idiot. What's going on with this guy? And that's how they sold it. They sold it as a status symbol. They sold it as a must-have. It was like jewelry for business people. And they really, really wanted to have it. And within a couple of years after launching, they controlled the smartphone market. They had, at their high, about 20% of the global smartphone market and 50% of the North American smartphone market in a couple of years. And to put the significance of that into context, it took the television 50 years to penetrate more than 50% of the North American market. This happened in a couple of years. This is all about the speed with which technology is changing our lives. And the first big iteration of this was the BlackBerry. And the event that changed their fortunes very quickly was an about face by Apple. Steve Jobs had always said he was never going to make a cell phone. He hated the carriers. He called them the four orifices, because you know, whatever you wanted to put down their network had to be on their terms, and it was expensive. He'd already made the iPod. He already had, you know, computers. It made no sense to him. And they saw the rapid spread of the BlackBerry. Google had a secret project. Apple had a secret project. And no one really believed that they could move that quickly, but they did. And within a couple of years, Steve Jobs was standing at a conference. It was in San Francisco, pointing to a map, pointing to a big screen and saying, iPod, cellular phone, get it? Do you know what we're doing? It's the iPhone. And, you know, of course, the typical Apple crowd, they were all raving and cheering. And within days, the huge fans of everything that Apple did were calling it the Jesus phone. So they had this built-in market that was aching to have something beautiful from Apple, as opposed to all the engineers and executives who loved this very functionary BlackBerry. You know, people who used the BlackBerry didn't care what it looked like. They cared about what it did. Steve Jobs sold something that was like jewelry to a crowd, an already loyal crowd of consumers that wanted that. And it was really only within a matter of years that they were outrun by Apple. And Apple had problems. Mike Lazaridis watched, it was all available on video. He watched it later the day in Waterloo when he was at home. I think he was working on having a workout at home, and he was watching it on the TV, and he thought, well, that's an impossibility, because you can't have maps, you can't have videos, you can't have photos on a phone, because they'll crash the network. And he was right. They did crash the network, but they brought a secret weapon onto the stage, which was what is a company now known as AT&T. And they signed a multi-year exclusive deal with Apple. Apple would only sell it to AT&T, which meant they had an enormous incentive to spend billions of dollars upgrading the network. They changed the game when they did that. And that was sort of the beginning of the end. And in addition, you had an awful lot of things going wrong. I don't know if you remember the patent lawsuit. There was a stock option scandal that they ultimately settled. And they were, they were scaling to supply the world BlackBerries and racing to meet that demand. So they just sort of looked at Apple out of the side of their eyes and said, well, that's interesting. That's a threat, but we got to keep, getting these phones out on time. And that's pretty well the arc of the story. And it happened really fast. And as we sort of said in the conclusion of our book, the race never ends. And the person who's out front in the beginning can fall back pretty quickly. And the leadership rotates back and forth.
While Steve Jobs was rolling out the iPhone, Jim Balsillie was in a race, a relentless pursuit of an NHL team. First the Penguins, then the Predators and the Coyotes, but never crossed the finish line and claimed the trophy. How much of an impact was that distraction from running BlackBerry? How much of that did that contribute to the downfall of BlackBerry?
I don't think it had any real impact. I think that I know from talking to Jim that he had a large team of people working on this. And he did fly from time to time and meet with the NHL people and had a lot going on to try and make it happen, because as you said, he kept trying and it kept not working. The National Hockey League, and he butted heads several times. That is not why they failed. CEOs have other interests and diversions all the time, whether it's buying the newest Mercedes or a new home in an exotic place. They always, have time for personal interests. I don't think that's why they failed. A major factor in the failure was that he and Mike Lazaridis fell out. A lot of it was over the patent lawsuit, and a lot of stresses for both of them. It was a very difficult time for both of them. They disagreed with the strategies. Ultimately, Jim was able to fix the problem, but at a great cost to the company and a great cost to both of their reputations. They had other much bigger challenges. The biggest problem was the two CEOs weren't speaking to each other by the end. And so you had so many obstacles to this company succeeding. The big one being Apple, the larger one being internal communications, internal cooperation, and legal threats. They had a lot going on.
Well, thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast, Jackie McNish, co-author of Losing the Signal, the untold story behind the extraordinary rise and spectacular fall of BlackBerry, which is the basis for the BlackBerry movie, which is in theaters now.
Thanks, Bob. It was great catching up with you.
Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Dwight Howard angers Chinese netizens after calling Taiwan a country. T1 League basketball star says he did not want to hurt anybody's feelings. The former NBA player recorded a promotional video for tourism in Taiwan with Vice President Lai Ching-te. During their conversation, Howard described how he had gained a, quote, whole new appreciation of this country, end quote, since he arrived last year to join the Taoyuan Leopards. The criticism of the United States sports star attracted 390 million views on the Chinese social media platform Sina Weibo. In Kyoto news, 2.15 million Toyota customers' data publicly accessible since 2013.
Potentially exposed information includes identification numbers and location data of vehicles that have used Toyota's telematics services between November 2013 and April of this year, though there has not been any indication that the data has been misused by a third party, the automaker said. Its subsidiary, Toyota Connected Corp., said the main cause of the problem was its failure to have its employees thoroughly follow rules about the handling of customer data. In the Hong Kong Free Press, Hong Kong security chief hits back a journalist group over suspension of newspaper comic strip. Junji's 40-year-old comic strip, Axe by Meng Pao, was openly criticized by government officials six times since last October. The city's journalist association said that Hong Kong cannot tolerate critical voices, whilst the security chief said the government must speak up, clarify, and condemn. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, after Democratic Party falsely reports source of $500,000 donation from FTX exec, Oregon officials slash fine, agree not to pursue criminal case. Democratic Party of Oregon officials knowingly filed a false report about the source of a $500,000 donation from Nishad Singh, an executive at disgraced cryptocurrency firm FTX, but state elections officials with strong ties to the party settled the matter without pursuing criminal charges. In Cairo TV, Seattle to pay more than $2 million to whistleblowers who revealed Mayor Durkin's texts had been deleted. The text messages were between Durkin, then Police Chief Carmen Best, and others during the height of the racial justice protests in the summer of 2020. The mayor's messages should have been preserved by law but were not. Investigators said Durkin's phone settings were manually changed in early July 2020 to delete all messages after 30 days. In the Times Colonist, scientists discover colossal underwater mountain off Vancouver Island. Measured by scientists aboard the U.S. research ship Okeanos Explorer, the seamount rivals Mount Baker and rewrites old nautical charts. The find, a third higher than previous estimates, said that the underwater mountain rises from a base sitting at 4,000 meters below the surface to its peak 895 meters below sea level. Measured top to bottom, it's roughly a kilometer higher than the peak of Whistler Mountain. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to curators of museums across British Columbia. One of my favorite is the BC Sports Hall of Fame and Museum at BC Place Stadium. It's BC Museums Week from May 14th to 20th. Go to your local museum and learn some history. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 14th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 14th of May in 1973, 50 years ago, NASA launched Skylab, the American space station, a mission that lasted almost 2 months? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.